And welcome everyone to an extremely special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. This is wild.
Yeah, tonight we're, I know I'm speaking for the both of us, we're super excited to be joined by, honestly, one of the greatest action film directors of all time, Mr. Rennie Harlan. Rennie is the director of Die Hard 2, Cliffhanger, The Long Kiss Goodnight, Deep Blue Sea, and this summer's Skip Trace with Jackie Chan and Johnny Knoxville. He's a complete legend. He's made some of our absolute favorite popcorn entertainments. It's a true treat and honor to have him here on the show with us. And rather than hear my voice ramble on, we're just going to jump right into it. A special thanks to mutual friend Juhani Nirmi for helping us get in touch with Rennie. So Rennie, welcome to the show, man. It's an absolute honor and privilege to have you here chatting with us about your work and about Skip Trace.
Thank you, Nick and Frank. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I'm talking to you from Beijing, China, and very happy. Your site and your show is very awesome, and you guys are true lovers of film, so I'm happy to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So your new film, very excited to see you work with Jackie Chan and Johnny Knoxville. What was it like bringing that project together and bringing them together on screen?
Funnily enough, I've almost worked twice with Jackie before. I was offered by New Line Cinema the original Rush Hour. I had a deal with New Line Cinema at that point many, many years ago. However, at that point, I was busy with a couple of other projects, and I ended up turning it down. And one of my genius decisions in my career. And years later, there was another project with Jackie that I was considering doing. And I met with Jackie in LA. We talked about making it. And it's kind of a very tragic story because there was one reason why the movie got canceled. And it's pretty much the most horrific reason one could ever think. The movie was called Nosebleed, and in the movie, Jackie Chan was a window washer at the World Trade Center. Oh, and wow. The whole movie, the action was built again on the acrobatics of him on these window washing rigs and all this stuff on the walls and the, you know, windows of World Trade Center, and he was in love with the waitress at the restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center. And so we were talking about making this movie, and then we know what happened. So that was the second time we talked about working together, and obviously very, very tragic how it all got canceled. Then Skip Trace came up a couple of years ago, and they had been developing it with another director. Then for reasons that I don't know, they parted ways, and then wanted to find another new director for the project, and they approached me, and I read the script and loved it and thought, you know, it's about time I work with Jackie. And a little over two years ago, I flew to Hong Kong to meet with Jackie and talk about the script and the project, and we really hit it off great. And then I continued developing the script. And at that point, we didn't have a co-star yet for Jackie. I started scouting locations and all that. And then eventually, toward the end of the summer, we were able to make a deal with Johnny Knoxville and felt that it was a really amazing pairing of two guys who are famous for doing amazing stunts. Only difference is that Jackie Chan is famous for always being successful in his stunts, and Johnny Knoxville is famous for always screwing up his stunts. So we thought it was a very fun pairing.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, you've worked with so many amazing stars. It seems fitting that you would get a chance to work with somebody like Jackie Chan, who's a legend of the, you know, the martial arts cinema and that kind of stuff. And now we'll get a chance to see you, you know, turn your, you know, directing hand at something like that, a genre that, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I'm sure there's been elements in some of your movies maybe, but this is your first time making a movie of this sort, you would say?
Yes, definitely. You know, I've done action, I've done fights and chases, and I've done some comedic stuff. But to do really this kind of a full-on action comedy with martial arts is a first. And you know, of course, I've been a lover of Chinese and Hong Kong cinema for decades, and admired Jackie. So it was really, really an amazing experience to be in the room with him. And his technique of doing stuff is really refreshing, and he's the Energizer Bunny. He's you know, not a young man anymore, but he was still game to do anything. And he was the first one on the set and the last one to leave. When we were leaving, you know, a location, it was getting dark, he would grab, you know, some chairs or a lamp stand or whatever, and he gave that example to rest of the crew and cast, like, help out the guys, let's rap together. And you know, that's the first star or first actor I've ever seen do that. And he always had a positive attitude, he always came to the set happy, and he was full of ideas. And the biggest thing I learned from this experience was that, you know, if you have the sort of childlike mind and openness on the set, nothing is impossible. And that doesn't really apply in America the same way, because in Hollywood, the filmmaking process is more organized and more pre-planned. Here, and at first it was kind of a surprise, not really a surprise because I know about Hong Kong movies, but still a little bit of a kind of a shock to my system, that where I'm used to planning everything, you know, all the action scenes and all the moves and videotaping them and being very exact about my storyboards and angles and shots. I quickly learned that though I try to rehearse things with my awesome fight choreographer, Wu Gan, who has worked with Jackie for years and years. We try to rehearse things and plan things so that we have the right breakaway props and furniture and right kind of things. Still, I learned that with Jackie, when he comes to the set, we'll explain what we have in mind, and he'll be like, okay, I like that, that's pretty good. Well, there, I think we could do a little better. And then we start rehearsing, and he's like, how about I do this? And then I do this, and then I take this thing, and then I break this on his head, and then I climb to this thing. And I would say, like, it's a great idea, but we don't have a breakaway thing, and we don't have the ladder that you have to climb, and we don't have the umbrella that you're going to, you know, fly down with. And he'll be like, don't worry, after lunch we will. And I learned that, you know, in America that would take like 2 weeks of prep. But in China, you know, we have 400 people in the crew, and I learned quickly that if you can think it, they will make it. And they just throw enough people at it, and miraculously after lunch, we had the breakaway props and furniture. We had all the tools, all the parts of the set that we needed, and we were able to do exactly what Jackie had in mind. And also, they over lunch, they rigged the wires and everything and the cranes there so we could do whatever we wanted. So that was liberating and exciting and inspiring, that you really realize that the only limitation is your imagination. And if you have the right attitude and right people to work with, you can make anything happen.
So Jackie Chan sounds pretty much as amazing as I thought he was. That's awesome.
Yeah. He's such a gentle guy, friendly to anybody and everybody. He doesn't make any difference between the producer and the guy who is carrying the electric cable. He'll be just as nice to everybody. And he'll, you know, surprise people and bring them pastries or cookies or refreshments on the set, or help the guy sweep the set or whatever it is. He's part of the team. And that's how he grew up, you know, in the Beijing Opera since he was 6 years old. He learned that you are part of the team and everybody does their share. And, you know, nobody is really better than the other person.
Yeah, I remember seeing Rumble in the Bronx in the theater with my dad, and it was one of the first times that I can consciously remember a movie theater crowd erupting into applause at the end of a film. And I think it was because people had just not seen Jackie Chan do that sort of stuff on the big screen in America. I know that he'd obviously been a success on video here and had a cult following, but I could be wrong. But I want to say that Rumble in the Bronx was one of the first really big breakout successes that he had at the box office. I don't even know if it made like $100 million or not, but that movie really just blew me away when I was younger.
Yeah, that was the first one that in America, you know, really brought him to the wider audience. And the interesting thing about his acrobatics and crazy stuff that he can do is that, of course, he has lots of skill. There's no question about it. He has unbelievable skills. But he told me, he said, the difference between me and the guy who can't do this is not that I'm so much more skillful. I just have more patience. And he says, if it takes me 150 times to do it, I'll do it 150 times, and there are not a lot of people who have the patience to do it. So, you know, when you see him do unbelievable things where he, like, kicks something in the air and grabs it and throws it and hits the next guy and then does something else, and it's all in, like, one shot, it's not because he's, like, crazy, crazy, crazy skillful or that it's CG or something. It's real, but it's maybe took, like, 87 takes to make it perfect.
One thing I've always been drawn to with your films, growing up and now as like a serious viewer of film as an adult, is your casting. And not so much with the hero or the star like Bruce Willis or Sylvester Stallone, but your villains. And one thing I've always been drawn to is I have to gush real quick and tell you that Cliffhanger is one of my all-time favorite films. And I don't even know how many times I've watched it. I've lost count. And how many times I've watched it with director's commentary. But John Lithgow in that film is one of the, in my opinion, is one of the greatest cinematic villains of all time. And I just wanted to ask you real quick. I just kind of needed to know how that came about with you casting a villain up, John Lithgow up against Stallone.
Well, first of all, thank you for your comment about casting. I love casting. And that's one of my favorite parts of the preparation process of a movie. And I think it's so important because, like, I always say, like, because people talk about, like, great actors, directors and stuff like that. And I say, you know, I don't think directors run an acting school. It's, you know, as a director, your job is to find the right person for the right role. And sometimes it's maybe an obvious choice or sometimes it's the obvious of that, opposite of that. But I think, you know, if you ever, like, read or listen to, like, Clint Eastwood or Scorsese and a lot of these people, it's like, it's not like they tell the actors how to do it. They, you know, you discuss the character and then you give the actor the freedom to play with it. And then you know, give them some tips and notes. But it's not like you are giving them line readings and telling them how to do their job. But the secret to being successful in that, of course, is that you found the right person for the right part. And I always say that in any movie, and especially in action movies, the heroes are only as good as the villain. It doesn't matter how awesome the hero is. If the villain is not strong, then, like, okay, well, anybody could take that guy. So, like, what's so special about it? And also, I like the villains to be good actors so that they really can, you know, rather than just being like strong guys or big guys or have a lot of guns, I want them to be intelligent and I want them to be interesting. And there's a funny story about Cliffhanger. Actually, my first choice for the John Lithgow part was the English rock star, Ryan Ferry. And
that's amazing.
That shows the variety of styles that can, you know, how a movie could be different. And I flew to London. I had dinner with Ryan Ferry and we talked about it a lot. And then ultimately, just, you know, timing wise and everything, it didn't work out. But it, like, obviously it would have been a completely different. And before that, I wanted David Bowie. And I went to New York to meet David Bowie. And I was in David Bowie's hotel room talking about the role. And then his music schedule, you know, our schedule changed, so he couldn't do it. So then I went to Brian Ferry. So I was, like, hell-bent to get, like, a rock star to play the bad guy.
And, oh, my God. God.
I don't think I've ever told this anywhere, so you are breaking new ground here. And then when that didn't work out, then I went back to the drawing board. I was like, okay, I'm running out of rock stars, so let's think of this in some other way. And then I thought of John Lithgow, whom I just had always liked him, and, you know, he had done some comedic roles and some, like, very sort of intellectual roles. And I was like, well, you know, what about somebody like that? You know, he could really, you know, I mean, he's a tall guy, but he's not, you know, he's not like you're going to, like, really fight him that much. But it's a fight of minds and intelligence and games. And so then I asked the studio what they thought, and they thought that's a really interesting idea. And I met with John and fell in love with him. He's, by the way, just the most awesome guy. And he just brought so much to the role, and I loved working with him. And I'd like to just, like, point out a couple of other villains in my movies. Like in The Long Kiss Goodnight, I had a couple of different kind of villains.
Yeah, like double, like David Moore. I mean, not to interrupt, but I was wanted to bring up Long Kiss Goodnight because I'm just, like, been obsessed with it for years. I think it's absolutely amazing. The casting that you did there is just perfect.
Yeah, well, first of all, Craig Bierko, who plays the sort of assassin character, was he had never done anything like this. He had done very little in general. He was totally a newbie. And I saw 80 actors for that role. And, you know, we had our sort of budget limitations and whatever. It wasn't like, okay, let's just get a superstar for every part. And so I saw 80 actors, and I saw a lot of the, you know, guys who are, you know, playing sort of like the typical bad guy thing. And I was looking for something different. And then when Craig came in and did this very, like, weird kind of, in a way, funny and very intelligent version of it, I was like, that's the guy that I've been looking for. I want him to be super smart, super funny, and just different from anything we've seen before. So that's how Craig, who was at that point a total unknown, he got that role.
And then teamed up with David Morse, who I just love. He's like the fake out villain in the movie, which I always loved. And I think David Morse is just terrific. He's so good in everything. Yep. Where was the inspiration there?
Yeah, he was just a great character actor. I had seen him in a few things, and I thought he feels like such a safe guy. He feels like a real guy's guy, and he's kind of feels like, okay, if you are in trouble and you go to David, you're going to be okay. So it was just, I needed a perfect fake out, like a guy that you never would think is the bad guy. So that's how I ended up on him. And then for Perkins, the sort of mastermind behind everything, Patrick Malahide, I don't know if he had ever done, I don't think he had ever done an American movie. He was well known in England, but I saw him in a couple of things, and I was like, again, like a guy who was super intelligent. The English accent doesn't hurt. And so I think about now, I think he probably did an American accent in the movie, if I recall correctly. But he was just a great actor. And again, you know, totally unknown in America, but I think brought a lot to the movie. And then I'm going to mention one more person just to brag, you know, like Brian Cox. You know,
the funniest scene ever in that movie with the dog.
Yeah, it was awesome. And I just want to say, like, you know, he hadn't done much of, like, he had done what was the part that he did before Hannibal? He had done, like,
yes, he's the original part. Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, he was the original that. But he wasn't really known. I bet, like, nobody in America knew who he was when they saw his face. And it's funny how after my movie, he became like a staple of every movie. Like, he's been in you know, Jason Bourne movies, and he's always like, yeah. And, you know, you need a professor or a scientist or a weird government guy. Like, everybody's always like, what about Brian Cox? So, I think he owes me dinner or something, but great talent, great talent. And yeah, so always with my movies, I've paid a lot of attention to the bad guys and of course the good guys. And sounds like bragging, but I've discovered a lot of actors maybe in the mainstream, a lot of people don't know that Viggo Mortensen had his first starring role in my little low budget horror film Prison in the late 80s. He had done like one role before that. He had a little role in Peter Weir's Witness, very, very small role, and that's it. And again, I saw over 100 actors for that lead role, and I was looking for the new James Dean, and he auditioned to me a couple of times, and I chose him, and he did a great job, and rest is history. And, you know, like when I did the Covenant, you know, all those guys I knew. It was like, I really wanted to find like fresh faces, and of those guys,
Taylor Kitsch.
Yeah, Taylor Kitsch had done one movie.
Sebastian Stan.
Taylor Kitsch had done Snakes on the Plane. And had like two scenes on that movie. Chase Crawford had never been in front of the camera, ever, not in TV, not in movies. Chase Crawford had done nothing. Toby Hemingway had done a little bit. Stephen Strait had done a couple of good things. Sebastian Stan had done very little. And you know, a lot of these guys became stars. So it's not because I'm a genius, but I just like, and I, of course, you know, listen to other people and take a lot of advice from other people. But it just, like, since you brought up the casting, I just wanted to bring a couple of examples to show that, you know, this is maybe lethal for a lot of actors who are seeking their breakthrough and haven't done much yet, because now everybody thinks that you can make it, because it's still like kind of a one in a million chance to get a lead role in a movie out of the blue. But it's possible, you know, if you have the talent. The looks, of course, don't hurt either, but the talent, you know, be different. Be something that is not like everybody else, and it's possible.
I know we want to be mindful of your time, but I do want to ask one question, because your films have always had such a fantastic look to them. And with the way that movies sort of have progressed throughout the years, and especially recently with the turn to digital, when you look at something like Cliffhanger and Die Hard 2 or Fort Fairlane, I mean, the filmic quality of something like Cutthroat Island, how amazingly cinematic it looks. How do you feel about the change from film to digital, and you know, where do you sort of stand on the aesthetic change that's happened in the industry?
That's a really good question, and I've had my battles with it, and I'm kind of lost, because I was fortunate enough to work in the sort of tail end of the era where that was before digital. And like for some people who are listening to this or reading this, you know, it's maybe like you can't even comprehend what that means. But when I was making movies like Fort Fairlane or Die Hard 2 or Cliffhanger or Long Kiss Goodnight and Cutthroat Island, there was no such thing as digital. It hasn't been invented yet. So we pretty much did everything for real. You know, we did some blue screen, green screen stuff mm-hmm. sometimes, but even that was, you know, it was done on film, and it was a complicated process, and like one blue screen shot took like 24 hours to render and to like manufacture, and they didn't look very good. And so to be able to go on real locations, like on Cliffhanger, go to the Italian Alps and shoot this stuff for real, it's Stallone and it's Lithgow and it's real helicopters on a real mountain, and on Cutthroat Island, we are sailing in Thailand yeah. with real ships yeah. between real islands. And be able to do this all for real, all the action, you know. We didn't have digital stunt doubles. It was like either the actor or stunt guys doing this stuff. And it was it was exciting. It was fun. It was challenging. And it was, I really felt like, you know, you really wanted to give the audience for their money's worth and show them that, look, it is Sylvester Stallone on this mountain. There's no way around. You're looking at him. It's his face. He's on the mountain. It's real. We really, you know, we spent the money and we made the effort to go into these dangerous places to deliver you the goods and tell you the story. And then, you know, when digital started, you know, of course, it's a great tool in many ways. It helps us and it makes stuff possible. But then when, you know, movies and, you know, I don't have to mention, we all know it's a, you know, superhero movies, especially when they have entire sequences that are completely CG, it's like you're actually watching an animated sequence. There could be like a 2-minute sequence where there's not one real thing in it. And it changed the movies a lot because it took away some of the danger because the audience knows that it's not the real actor and it's not even a stuntman doing that. And when people can fly and they can do anything and they are smashing through things and into things, and it's animated, it changes the movie-going experience. And then you have to rely on, like, insane mayhem. Instead of, like, having a fight with two guys and they are in a room or on a rooftop or in a mountain or whatever, like, you have to smash the two guys through 24 skyscrapers to get the audience excited. If the audience doesn't get it, they're like, well, that wasn't very exciting. And it kind of, like, replaces suspense and danger with spectacle. And I know, you know, it's like I'm totally, you know, it's like worth nothing what I'm saying because we are so far beyond it. And, you know, I love all these movies and I enjoy them. But sometimes to me, it's or many times for me, it's a pity that that the digital has so completely taken over and we can only, you know, imagine where it's going to go in the future. There's going to be a time when we, because we have now a lot of digital characters. I mean, all in these big movies, all actors are scanned and then they have models of the actors and that's what they use for a lot of the stunt work. They are digital models of the actors. And in the future, you know, that's just going to increase and we're going to start seeing dramatic scenes, you know, as long as they get all the facial expressions and everything really down, which will happen in a few years, we're going to start seeing digital actors in a lot of situations. And yeah, so call me old fashioned, but I really enjoy it when you see actors in real situation. And I appreciate it when I see, you know, Tom Cruise on the side of a plane for real. I can tell that it's for real. It feels different.
Go ahead, Frank.
I was going to say, I think you summed that up perfectly because, I mean, Nick and I love all sorts of films, but, you know, particularly for us and a lot of people who listen to our podcast, I mean, we'll take Bruce Willis fighting Franco Nero or Matthew Modine and Frank Langella swashbuckling. I mean, there's just a cinematic authenticity to your films.
Thanks.
That makes them so, you know, that just makes them a treasure for people like us. So I completely agree with everything you just said.
Well,
I mean, I think you nailed it.
I appreciate it. And with, you know, Skip Trace, which will come out around July in China and in US and everywhere else, those who like the authentic stuff will get a lot of it because in Skip Trace, everything is real. And it's the actors mostly doing everything, some stunt work, but you know, with two maniacs like Jackie Chan and Johnny Knoxville, it's like impossible to hold them back. And so
probably you could ask them to do whatever, and you could ask them to do whatever, and they'd probably do it with a smile on their face. And that's one of the things that, you know, when you do watch a Jackie Chan movies, you know, probably aside from a handful of them, but yeah, that guy's really doing all that stuff. I mean, he's going crazy and, you know, doing stuff that no rational thinking person probably would ever even attempt or dream of doing. So there's certainly a level of, like you said, there's a level of danger that's missing from action adventure films of late because of a more turn to digital. And, you know, with these kind of movies and watching the movies from the past, you know, you really get a sense of how things have changed, certainly.
Yeah. And it was awesome opportunity to sit around with Jackie and some of his, because he has his Jackie Chan stunt team, but there are now like four generations of it. And some of the original Jackie Chan stunt team guys came to visit us, and we had dinner with them, and they are all in their 60s, and, you know, they are missing fingers, and they are not walking so good, but they still have a great spirit. And to hear stories from, like, the original police story, where there's the famous scene, for example, where, like, a double-decker bus comes to a stop, and these guys fly through the windshield from the upstairs and slam onto the ground on their backs and that kind of stuff. And I was like, how did you guys do that? And like, how did you hide the wires? And Jackie was like, and these guys were like, when we used to do movies in the beginning, you know, there were no wires. We didn't even have stunt mats. We just did it for real. And in that particular stunt, you know, the idea was that the double-decker bus almost hits this car. And so they are inches away from each other. And so when the guys fly out the upstairs windshield, they actually crash on the roof of the car. And then so the roof of the car will sort of soften the blow a little bit. However, the bus stopped too early or the car stopped too early. But anyhow, there was no car under them. So they literally flew from upstairs of the bus on their backs onto the ground.
I'm very excited for this film.
Awesome.
For Skip Price.
Awesome. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And their chemistry was fantastic together. The movie is very funny, and the action is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I like Johnny Knoxville's transition from stunt comedy to action films in a way. I thought he was great in the film with Schwarzenegger, Last Stand. So when I saw that he was in your film, I got really excited for it because I do like Johnny Knoxville a lot. So this is very exciting.
Yeah, and there's also like some really like heartfelt scenes between them as friends, and like really beautiful emotional scenes. So it's like it's a whole range from madcap adventure to complete ridiculous comedy to also like really good old buddy stuff.
And I don't know if you're able to say anything about anything in the you know, we want to be mindful of your time. I know we could talk to you all night. So is there anything that you can bring up that's coming in the near future, more action adventure excitement?
I can't name names, but I can tell you that I came to China 2 years ago. I finished Skip Trace. Now I'm making another movie here, and it's a very big, amazing action-adventure movie that I think you guys will really enjoy. And we start shooting in the end of the summer, and we're just prepping it right now, and we have an awesome team. And I'm super excited to be in China. This is a very, very, very exciting place to be right now, and I'm having a lot of fun.
Awesome. Very cool. Something
that's fantastic.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. We'll be in the theaters next year, and just working away right now. And I gotta run now. It's morning here in Beijing, but
it was just so much fun.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on, man. This was incredible.
It was my pleasure. Great to talk to you guys, and I wish you luck. And let's do this again. You know, I'm game to do this. You know, anytime. It's fun to talk to people who love movies, especially if they love my movies. Yeah,
absolutely. Anytime.
We'll keep
okay. More than welcome.
Yeah,
anytime.
We'll
keep in touch.
Sure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.